learning what it means to have God love me. And it has its fun days, it's not fun days, it has its good days, its bad days. But still, it's way better than the life I used to live. So much better. So I'm learning what it means to let him love me. I'm recovering from spiritual and emotional abuse. And I've had addiction to food and work and control. That's been a big issue, control. I've had issues with pornography, with alcohol, with rage, with panic, with depression. And so the list goes on. We're going to kind of revisit something tonight that we've talked about quite a bit. It maybe not in these words. I think there was a lesson maybe a couple years ago by this title. I'm not sure. Overcompensation. I know we did a whole study on codependency, and a lot of it focused on overcompensation. The word was used a lot in the book. But I just want to talk about overcompensation. You can throw stuff at me when I say this, like, duh, Captain Obvious. No childhood is trauma-free. Oh, wow. We drove all this way for you to tell us that. But, like, now you know. You got your money's worth. So trauma is trauma, no matter how hard or how it's packaged, really, you know? We hear each other's stories. You know what troubles me sometimes is somebody will tell their story, and then somebody will kind of come up next to me after it's done and say, well, I don't ever want to tell my story because it doesn't compare to that. My childhood was not near that bad or whatever. And so one of the problems with a ministry like this is we begin to have like a pain contest or a trauma contest. Who's had the worst trauma? Who's had the worst upbringing? Who's got the worst story to tell? Who has the most drama in their backstory? Who, you know, and really, can we just all agree on trauma is trauma? Trauma is trauma, whether it's self-imposed, family-imposed, life-imposed, disease-imposed, economically imposed. It doesn't matter, you know. You might have grown up in a war zone. Trauma is trauma. And we just had the three grandkids this week. No, you're going the wrong way with this. No. We had a good time. It was not trauma. We loved it. But I noticed again, because I forgot this, because my kids, do you know our daughter is freaking 35 today? Well, okay, some of y'all, see, I can't even say that. And, well, that's nothing. We've got kids that are this old. See, I made my point. But anyway, her three kids were at our house. And every little thing is high drama. He looked at me wrong. Oh, really? Wow, cut you to the heart, right? But you don't know, Pa. He looked at me wrong. Somebody comes running. You know, I just hit my sister. Why'd you hit your sister? Because she stuck her tongue out at me. That's pretty serious. You'll probably never get over that. But you stop and think about this, that when you're little, there are a lot of little things that happen to you that when you look back on them, they weren't that big. They were huge then. And no joking, you know. And then there are big bad things that happen when we were little. There is nobody who doesn't have some sort of backstory. We all have a backstory, every one of us. And none of us exit childhood wound-free. None of us do. We all enter adulthood broken. All of us do. And most of us think, up until we reach a certain age, most of us think that our childhood was normal. Is that your story? I didn't see anything wrong in the way my father treated me for years. It was my normal. There wasn't anything wrong in the way he spoke to me, the way he dehumanized me, the way he beat me at times. There was nothing wrong with that. It's when I got older and I looked back and I thought, that wasn't normal. That wasn't right. And I got into Celebrate Recovery, now Pathway, and I started hearing other people's stories and I thought, I'm not the only one who thought their childhood was normal up to a point. And then you reach a certain point of maturity, a certain point of aha, and it's like, it wasn't normal at all. None of us exit childhood and enter adulthood without being bent and broken to some degree. So we enter our adulthood unbalanced. We have lost our equilibrium because we're broken, we're bruised. It's hard to keep our balance in life, emotionally, spiritually, relationally, in every way. It's hard to keep our balance. And if there's nothing else about the human psyche, is we want to somehow feel like we're in a state of equilibrium or balance. I don't care what you want to call that, comfort, safety. Do you have some other words for it? I mean, seriously. I mean, but you get what I'm saying about balance, about equilibrium. We want to feel some sense of wholeness and well-being, that I'm balanced, I'm not falling over, I'm okay. So I'm kind of calling that balance or equilibrium. The problem with this is if we were broken and bruised and bent when we were kids, we push toward this balance and we always push past center. If you think of a pendulum never goes this way. A pendulum always goes this way. And then it goes this way. It never stops at a balanced place. It never stops in the middle where we have equilibrium. It always overcompensates. It always goes past middle. And yet we mess with this pendulum and we push on it and we try to manipulate it, and we can't get a sense of balance because we always overcompensate. We push too hard. I think about, and there's maybe some of y'all here who are like experts in this. I won't mess with you if you are. But if I understand judo correctly, isn't judo using the opponent's force against them? When they push or use a force, you don't use your force. You let their force take them down. And we're a bunch of judo failures. I mean, you think about that. We're exerting all this force to try to win at life and to try to be successful and try to gain equilibrium. And life just uses that force against us. And boom, we find ourselves on the mat over and over looking up. Still, there's something inside. We want this equilibrium. And so let's introduce another word that we've used a lot into the mix. Still, as human beings, as adults, we want some feeling that we're in some sort of control of our life. You know, equilibrium and control are kind of two sides of the same coin. I want to feel like I don't necessarily want to be the boss of everybody, and I don't necessarily want to be the boss of my whole life, but I want to feel like I have some semblance of control, self-control if nothing else. You know, at least that, some sort of control in my life. And the two things that I've always pushed for, and I'm going to assume that you do too, the two things I always push for is I want some control over my own personal safety, and I want some sort of control over my own personal sense of well-being, pleasure. Maybe that's not the right word, but I want to feel good every now and then, you know. I want to feel good about myself and about life and about, you know, where I'm at, my career, whatever. I want to feel good about that every now and then. And so we try to control life to make that happen. And again, in our attempt to control, we almost always push too hard and we push it past center. If you don't believe me, think about this. How many of us you don't have to raise your hands. Well, you might want to. How many of us, when we became parents, looked back on our childhood and said, I will never treat my children that way? Oh, so we do see a show of hands. How many of us say, I came up poor, my kids will want for nothing? You know? How many of us were beat half to death and said, I will never raise a hand to my child? You know? So we're getting, you see what I'm saying? Sometimes our kids need their heinies warmed. We ain't going there. We're going to overcompensate and say, no, none, you know. We're going to overcompensate for everything. And so we wind up spoiling our children with all kinds of stuff they don't need because they're not going to be poor like I was. Or we feed them. We used to make our kids eat everything on their plate. You know why? Well, I don't know why she did it, but I did it. It's because when I was a kid, I left the supper table hungry. That's part of my weight problem now, is because I eat because I didn't have enough when I was. It wasn't that we were poor. I don't know why my mom didn't cook enough for a teenage boy. I had a bunch of sisters, and she ate like, I don't mean to be sexist, okay? But she was a woman feeding women, and I was a growing boy, and I needed food, and it wasn't there. It's not my mom's fault I ate too much now. It's my fault. Not blaming her for that. But, you see how this overcompensation does. With our kids, we always made sure they had all the food they needed, and you can eat all you want and eat more, and, you know, I was more so about that than her because she didn't have that issue, but I did, you know, eat. You get the picture that we overcompensate in our own lives, and then we do it with our children. So I just want to, okay, I'm just going to take a chance, and I'm going to open. You've heard the term. Some of y'all hate this term, but some of you like it because I think it's kind of cool. I'm going to turn this in from a lesson to a testimony. I'm going to turn it into my own testimony toward the end. And I'm going to tell you what happens to me personally. This is my own story, okay? I'm just opening up, telling you my story. I haven't done that for a while. But this is what happens to me when I try to take control. Or if you want to put it in another term, when I try to push toward equilibrium, when I try to establish balance on my own, by my own means, my own ingenuity, my own willpower, my own desire, this is what happens to me. When my life is feeling out of sorts at all, when I'm feeling pressured, if I feel depression coming on, if I feel fatigue coming on, trying to think of some of my other triggers. If there's been some relational turmoil with people that matter to me, that I care about, that puts my mind and my feelings in disarray. And the two things that I use to try to bring my mind back into a good state is I use food and I use alcohol. Those are the two things that will bring my mind. It doesn't last, but if y'all who have these issues, you say, how long does that work? About that long. You know, it doesn't work very long. But that's what I'll use to try to trick my mind into thinking that all is well. Everything's okay. And I use those things to try to, you know, Dr. Phil would say, so how's that working for you? It doesn't. And I even tell myself going in, this isn't going to work for long. But sometimes I'll just say, well, what the heck? It'll last for 5 or 10 minutes. So, yeah, we'll go ahead and eat an extra burger or, you know, whatever. Slice of delicious pie that my wife made or whatever. It's all her fault. I don't deal with this so much anymore, but I remember some of the deepest, darkest depression that I got into. I had some really dark times back in my 20s. Dark, dark, suicidal times. I don't know if I've shared this with y'all, but I had the tree picked out that I was going to run into. Anybody remember what K-cars are? Chrysler made them. I had a little K-car. I was going to run it into that oak tree on Nicholasville Road between Nicholasville and Lexington. I was going to do it at like 85 miles an hour, and it'd all be over. That's how depressed, that's how dark those days were to me. And what I found out about myself was that my depression, that doesn't mean yours, my depression is self-pity gone wild. That's the source of my depression, of feeling so sorry for myself and feeling like nobody cares about me, feeling like I'm not on anybody's radar, feeling like my pain is worse than anybody's in the world, feeling like I'm the only one that has been dealt this bad of a hand. Just self-pity absolutely gone wild inside my mind and my heart. And it gets heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier. So I'm trying to fight this. I'm trying to battle my way out of it. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. When I try to take control of my own sense of well-being, my own sense of worth, it goes to self-pity. And then the self-pity just goes wild with depression. It has not happened. That has not happened probably in the last 15 or 20 years. But I remember those days. I remember what, and some of y'all are shaking your head, yes, like, yeah, I've been there. I know what that's like. That is a dark, dark, when you don't want to get out of bed in the morning. When you get up and say, what is the use of putting my shoes on today? Life is not worth living. Okay, so that's two. This is a big thing with me. If I ever feel like I'm losing my purpose in life, that I've become irrelevant, that I've become useless, that I've become obsolete. How's that word? Ain't that a good word? I feel obsolete. My overcompensation for that is to work my ass off. I am going to bust myself if it kills me. I'm going to prove my worth through hard work. That's what the way I was raised. The only way I ever got on my dad's radar was hard work. Some of y'all are shaking your head. You've been there. Yeah. So I work until it nearly kills me. And then I wake up and I think, ain't nobody watching. Why'd I do this for? Nobody cares. Nobody's watching. I got no brownie points for this. Just a lot of sweat and I'm out of breath. And maybe in a little bit I'd worked off some calories that I got from eating too much. That's all I got out of this. But that is my personal MO. And I still struggle with this some. I still struggle with this. Is if I start to feel obsolete, I just work harder. And probably the cause of feeling obsolete is fatigue, and so you need to rest instead of work harder. But my default setting is just try harder. Just work harder. Y'all are seeing parts you don't want to see, aren't you? Panic. I used to live with horrid panic attacks. I haven't had any. I've had a couple little ones in the last couple months. No, last couple years. I don't know about you and panic, if y'all ever deal with that. Mine hits me in the middle of the night. That's always when it hits me. And it comes completely out of the blue. I've never been able to connect the dots with where it came from. It'll just arbitrarily hit me. And in me, it's not a thinky thing. It's not a calculated in the head thing. It's more down, it's more visceral. It's right here where your stomach is upset. Anybody identify with that? Your stomach is upset. It's bubbling kind of weird. You don't feel nauseated, but you just feel this terrible feeling of apprehension, and there's no handle to it. It's like, why do I feel this? I don't know why I do. I just feel it. And then with me, I usually attach that to something that goes from okay to average to bad to worse to catastrophic to World War III to the history of mankind's over. Larry taught me a word a long time ago, catastrophize. I love that word. I catastrophize it, you know, and it could be the least little things. It years ago when it was really bad, it could be squeaky brakes. Literally, it could be, and I think, oh shoot, the brakes are going out. We don't have money to pay for that. We got, you know, you see where this is going? It's going to break the bank to try. And when I take it in, they're going to find out that something else is wrong, which means that has to be replaced, which means, oh shoot, can't feed the kids, whatever. You know what I'm saying? I haven't had any of those in a long time because I can spot that now. When that feeling starts here, I can spot that and say, I know where you're from. I know what you're trying to do. It's not going to work. But that's the panic thing. Trust issues. I'm much more trusting of people than I used to be, but I still have my trust issues. I don't list that as one of my primary issues, but I still have that a lot. And I've tried to ask myself, why? Where does that come from? And here's the dots I've connected in me, and I could be off, because you should not try to do your own self-therapy. But I've talked with recovery partners and talked in group and feel like I kind of have a handle on this. So it's not just self-diagnosis. It's with the help of other people. But trust issues that I have with other people, with me a lot of time, is I'm going to punish you for the crimes of my caregivers. Because of the way they treated me, if you resemble them in any way, I have people in my life who literally, when they talk in a forthright way, they're not here, none of you all, but when they talk in an assertive way, that's a better way to say it. When they talk in an assertive way, I swear it's my dad. It everything inside me goes to the same place it did when I was a little boy. Any of y'all got stuff like that? I mean, you've got people who remind you to a T of people from your past who hurt you. It may be tone of voice. It may be that they're manipulative. It may be they're deceitful. It may be they're cruel. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But just this week, I had somebody talk to me, and for a split second, it was like, oh, dadgum, that's my dad. And then I thought, no, that's not. This has nothing to do with that. I just felt that. You know what I'm saying? So my trust issues are a lot of times me punishing the person in front of me for the crimes committed against me back then. What is foo?
Family of origin.
Yes, foo. That's it. Yeah. Extended family, blood kin. Yeah, yeah, good. Fooey on that. That's good. So, yeah, whoa. That was great. That was awesome. Instead of foo, family of origins, call it people of origin, call it poo.
Hey, we got to deal with it.
Yeah, everybody has to deal with it. That's good. All right. Back to something completely serious. Okay, so I here again, I don't remember this. Some of these things I've listed tonight I still deal with on a pretty regular basis. But a lot of them I don't, but I still remember them. They're like old, I was going to say friends, more like old enemies. I don't like to see when they come up the sidewalk. I don't really want to answer the door and let them in. But another one is chronic worry. I used to be the kind of person who had a contingency plan for everything. And if he says this, then this is what I'm going to say to him. And then if he says this, then I'm going to say that. And if this doesn't work out, then I can go with plan B. And if plan B doesn't work out, then I got plan C to cover for plan B. So I had contingency plans on contingency plans. And hardly any of this stuff ever happened, but buddy, I was ready if it did. You know? And I was juggling all those balls in the air at the same time. Seriously? You talk about an energy drainer, a brain drainer, to keep all these balls up in the air. But the reason that I did that is I was pushing back against the voice in my head that said all the time, you're a failure. You are stupid. You will never amount to anything. And so a huge part of my life was to try to prove to my father, even after he died, a huge part of my life was to try to prove to him, I am not a failure. I'm going to overcompensate. I'm going to have plans to cover plans to cover plans so that I extremely minimize the chance of failure, which happened anyway. But buddy, I was trying not to be a failure in any way because I didn't want him to be right. I wanted to be right. So chronic worry, boy, I live there. I don't so much anymore. I think she wishes I did worry a little more than I did at this point. She has to poke me with a stick every now and then to make sure I'm still wiggling. So anyway, now this is a current issue, and you all have been so patient with me. Seriously, I'm not joking. And when I say this, you're going to really break out. But I talk too much. Yes. Yeah, I know. Go figure. Where did you get that one? You're pulling that one out of the air, Wendell. But I'm really working on it, especially one-on-one. I'm really working on that and have been for the past 10 or 12 years to become a better listener. But I have to ask myself, why do I talk too much? I mean, you know, It's embarrassing, yeah. It's embarrassing to get up in front of you and talk about it. Well, it's not really anymore because you kind of know who I am. But I have to ask myself, where does this come from? And part of it is that I'm clamoring for the attention and the affirmation that I didn't get when I was a kid. I know everybody had terrible things happen when they were young, so this is going to seem like Mickey Mouse to a lot of us here. But to me, it was trauma. My father never one time ever told me he was proud of me. Never, ever. And I was a good boy. I did everything I could to be a good boy. I didn't live a rebellious, crazy life. I was trying to be good. And yet he never one time, even when I got up and got in the ministry and was pastoring churches, never one time. When I graduated college, graduated seminary, nothing. Never, I'm proud of you, son. So I think part of why I talk so much a lot is somebody please tell me they're proud of me. But when we're over tonight, please don't do that. I'll see right through it. Thank you. Now see, I'll take that. And the other part that I've realized about my own story is that if I stop talking, that gives the floor to you, which means I'm no longer in control of this conversation. I can't have that. I've got to be in control here. I see some smiles. I think there may be some others of us sitting here. Shoot, you didn't have to say that. But don't you think that goes to the heart of a lot of us? We don't want to give the other person, because we lose control of the conversation. I want to get good at losing control of the conversation. I literally do. I want to get good at that and feel comfortable with that and feel happy about that. So I'm a little bitter than I used to be. Am I? She's not going to say. I'll let you handle that one. Okay, so here's the last one. We're running out of time. Sorry about that. Anger and rage. I still got a lot of that in me. I used to holler at my family, but nobody else. It's weird. I never showed my anger toward anybody else except my immediate family. I didn't physically abuse, but I verbally was very demonstrative with my anger. And now, really, I don't yell at anybody but me. So my list of people to yell at is getting smaller and smaller. But I could get up and tell them how it was yesterday, me building the shelves in the pantry. Did you see her? She's like, oh, Lord. I mean, I'm not a carpenter. I suck at carpentry. No, she's not going to ask me to build anything else. I have a little black finger to show you that is proof of my carpentry work. But I have all my fingers. They didn't cut any off. So that's a good thing. Yeah, it's not too bad. I've tried to dig into that. I've tried to dig into what's the source of my anger. And for me, it's me pushing back against imperfection. I want to get it right, and I want to get it right the first time. You know, I don't necessarily get mad at other people anymore because I've got forgiveness for them. It's you're human. You can mess up. But I'm not yet to offer myself that kind of grace, to allow myself to mess up and be okay with that. So, yeah, yesterday there was a little bit of French spoken in the... She's rolling her eyes. A lot of French? She had to put earplugs in. But we did get the shelves built, and now she's got them all stocked with veggies, and we're good. So anyway, it's not right for me to talk about this stuff and assume that I know where you're at. And early on when I was preparing this lesson, that's what the approach I was going to take, is kind of assume that this is the way everybody overcompensates. And I thought, you can't do that. Because everybody overcompensates in a different way. So I thought, well, just tell your own story then. Just tell how you overcompensate, And some of this is still active. The books are still open, and others I kind of feel like they've kind of been healed or whatever you want to say. But I think the reason that they pay me to be in charge of Pathway is because I'm the best screw up. I'm the professional screw up. And so if you want to know how to screw up, I can teach you how to do that. And I can hopefully encourage you in how to be a happy screw up and how to find healing for your screwing uppering as we go along. But that's me. And so I think by your body language you can identify with some of this, that we overcompensate. So what's the answer to this? What's the answer to this? It is so simple. Step one. We admitted we were powerless over our addictions and our compulsive behaviors, and that our life had become unmanageable. There you go. When I forget that, when I begin to walk away from that, I know I'm in trouble. But when I go back to that and say, dude, you're powerless. I don't want power. I don't need power. It takes power to overcompensate. I don't want that power. I want to give that up. And then I want to look to the one who does have power, our higher power, and say, this is your job. And it's a big one. You better get to work. But it's your job. And the more I do that, the more I find he deals with these things in his way, in his time. And I wake up one day and say, you know what, I don't think that's an issue anymore. And then I find I have five others waiting in its place. So we start to deal with them. But, and you know what's helped more than anything is to be with you all. Because we're all screw-ups. And we all admit it. Ain't nobody trying to hide they're a screw-up. And that makes this a very safe place and a very healthy place and a place that I have found I find healing. So, Lewis, it's all yours, dude.